Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Monday, August the 22nd. I'm sure the whole world knows that we're getting a lot of rain here in North Texas. So it's like we're not flooded completely, but we do have a lot of rains. And there are some parts of the area where driving has become dangerous, actually, and they're telling people not to drive. As we do on Mondays, we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, who is apparently... Bill, right before we came on the air, you were asking me if Al Gore was on his way to DFW to resolve the rain, because it's all everything is climate change. So I'm assuming that
yes,
the rains that we got today are because of climate change.
Oh, obviously. I mean, and if you didn't get any rain, it would be because of climate change.
Yes.
And if you get snow, it's climate change. Everything is climate change, and I think that we really should, on our side, throw in the towel and realize that no matter what happens in the world, it's climate change.
Well,
and it's bad.
You know,
it's bad.
That's right.
No such thing as good climate change.
That's right. Well, the Mets and the Yankees are playing tonight, so whoever wins or loses, it's because of climate change. How's that?
No question about that. It is ridiculous when they start attributing almost anything in the world to climate change. And I get the feeling that what we're dealing with here is a bunch of hungry academics who want grants, and so they will start this intersectionality between Milky Way candy bars and climate change. And you get a grant, and you can live on it for a couple of years and write your thesis. But I do think it's become absurd and very, very anti-intellectual.
Oh, yes. I think when everything is climate change, then it ceases to be science, and it becomes just a crazy idea. But if the former vice president does come to town, Bill, I do have a question for him, because we have gotten a lot of rain in the last 12 hours, like 8 inches, 8.5 inches. How they measure that, I'm not sure, but that's what they say. And at the airport, it's a little closer to 9 inches. But the question I would have for the vice president is, you know, how do you explain what happened in 1932 and in 1912? Because we got more rain back then. And nobody back then was talking about climate change. So what was their explanation back? And because, you know, they were posting on the TV the rainfalls over the years.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what we got today is actually the fourth highest one. And number one and number two go back to 1912 and 1932. So I don't know what we called it back then. Maybe we called it rain, Bill. I don't know.
Weather.
Okay.
We called it weather. Yeah. Yes, this was before the age of the Eveready battery, which whose stock goes up every time there's a bad weather event. You know, I've wondered the same thing. I recall that there was a big storm in New York. What was it? About 10 years ago, Hurricane Sandy, and they said this is the second or third worst storm of New York, and it's caused by climate change. And I wondered what the other ones were. And one was in 1826. Now, I don't know how much bad air came out of cars in 1826, but I don't think any. I look back, the car wasn't invented for another 100 years. But you have these statistics they give you, and then you go back in history and realize they had the same problems and the same occasional events back in the age before cars and the pre-industrial revolution era. And I really wonder whether we're on the right track on climate change. I know that there are some things coming out, I think some new books coming out, that raise questions, not about whether we have climate change. We have climate change all the time, but whether the results of the climate change will be quite as devastating as people think. If we did nothing, for example, what would happen?
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert, but I'm not so sure we have any experts on that. But
right.
I do know one thing. The world will not come to an end.
No. No, and that's the problem. And that's the problem, Bill, that there is climate change. I mean, you know, there is climate change. There's always been climate change. The climate has changed forever. But the question is, they've taken it to such a level of religion now. It is basically a level of either you are with us or you're against us type of discussion. Either you are a denier or you believe in climate change. And it's like there's nothing more rational in between. Yeah, I remember recently this fellow put a post or something up, you know, complaining about all these fires in the West Coast. And then
yes.
he says, and look at all these fires, and we're still using fossil fuels. And I just kind of said to myself, what the heck does that mean? So if we didn't use fossil fuels, the fires wouldn't take place?
Well, that's apparently the attitude. We have climate change, they'll say. It's getting warmer, and warmer is closer to fire, and you get closer, and maybe there'll be a spark. And dry weather, God knows we've always had dry weather. One of the tragedies of the Depression era was the Dust Bowl in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And that was long before we were using all this aviation fuel and car fuel. I think that the science of this has gotten so mixed up with the politics of it that we really may never know the truth. And I
right.
don't think that the news I don't think the news organizations make much of an effort to get to the truth. I
no.
really don't.
Not on this topic, because this is one of their favorite topics.
Yes.
I mean, this is one of the things that they believe in. There's very little curiosity in the newsroom about this issue. I mean, you would expect reporters who, after all, are taught to be curious and taught to, you know, ask the follow-up question, you would expect them to, you know, to ask some of the questions that you've asked over the years when we do these podcasts about, you know, this or that. But it seems that they accept anything that has to do with climate change, they accept it. And
Absolutely.
There's not that journalistic curiosity that I thought they used to teach them that in – I thought they taught them that, I should say, in journalism school. That's what I thought a journalist was, a person who was always challenging whatever he was listening to, Bill.
Yeah, well, that's what I thought also. And when I was at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia, way back decades ago, they tried to do that. And they called it a trade school. Well, it was a trade school, but it was a very good trade school. And I learned a lot in my time there, a great deal. Now, apparently, the idea of the journalist is not to report the news, but to improve society. I want to uplift. I want to uplift society. I am a good person. I want other people to be a good person as well. Arthur Hayes Sulzberger was not necessarily I always revered, but he was publisher of the New York Times for – number of years, and he said it best. He said, it's our job. No, we will tell you, he said, which way the cat is jumping. It's the public's job to take care of the cat. And that's true.
Mm-hmm.
It's up to the news media to tell you what is happening and up to the public to do something about it. Now, that doesn't mean news media can't have opinions. They have an editorial page. As long as it's separate from the news pages, that's good. And they may have a bias towards certain kinds of stories. Well, all right. If the publisher or the editor-in-chief likes weather stories or is particularly interested in the trajectory of the space race, okay, you know, each newspaper will have its favorite stories. But what you have today in many news organizations is a kind of predetermined news, and the stories seem to be selected to reflect the editorial opinion of the paper, which is what used to go on in the 19th century. A newspaper would have a political party. And I think that we really miss the benefits of truly or at least attempted objective journalism. Now, the modern era of journalism was begun by Joseph Pulitzer. which is why there's a Pulitzer Prize. And at Columbia, the original name of the school was the Pulitzer School of Journalism. He was the one in the early part of the 20th century who said, we've got to get away from newspapers being identified with parties, and it's our job to tell people the complete story. I think we were making a lot of progress in that direction. I think in particular during World War II, when the journalism was so surprisingly good. It really was. There have been many questions asked as to why it was so good and why journalists began to develop reputations as people you could trust in World War II. But then came the later era in the 1960s, and I think it all started to come apart, and that we had what was commonly known as the new journalism, and the new journalism was not necessarily based on what the baseball hitter would do at the plate, but what he was thinking. I remember Clifton Daniel at the New York Times, who was the executive editor for a while, he said, I want to know what the golfer was thinking. Well, of course, aside from the fact that I don't think too many people care,
right.
But the problem with that whole setup, as he expressed it, was an obvious one. The only person who knows what the golfer was thinking is the golfer, and he might not tell you the truth. In other words, there's no way to check the story. The golfer says, well, I was thinking about my wife and my two kids out there in Atlanta, Georgia, and how I wanted to join them that night. It may be completely made up, but how would you know? So a lot of the stuff was phony to begin with, but also the new journalism carried with it the idea that journalism was more than journalism. It was literature. It was the story of our time. It had as an objective improving the society. The journalist should not be objective. The journalist should be more subjective. And I think that was a slippery slope, and we're not at the bottom of the slope yet.
Yes, I agree with you. I was just thinking there while you were saying that the newspaper man wanted to know what somebody was thinking. When Ralph Branca gave up that home run to Bobby Thompson, if they had asked him what he was thinking, I don't think he was thinking about giving up a home run. So
no, he wasn't. Well, I think the best. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say you probably have a better example than I do.
No, well, one example, and I don't know if it was journalistic or actually historical, but Admiral Spruance, who commanded our forces at Midway brilliantly, was asked, Admiral, what were you thinking when you realized you'd won the battle of Midway? And he said, probably nothing. that was the end of the story.
Right.
You know, I think if people ever told you what they really were thinking at times of some great stress, the answers would surprise you. I recall back in 1962, during the Cuban Missile Crisis,
yes.
I was in Washington during that period, and I was at the CIA, and it began to get very serious, and they started handing out the books at the CIA, which were your directions in case of a nuclear attack on Washington. Now, I don't think I would have gotten too far with my car in case of a nuclear attack on Washington, but that they had to do it, and they gave you the location of where you were to go. They didn't give you the menu. They didn't give you the menu, but they told you where you were supposed to go in case of an attack. And, people must assume that at a time like that, when the books come out, you're thinking terribly serious things. I mean, it's, after all, an international crisis. And I guess you are to a degree, but one of the things I worried about, I had just bought my car. And I was worried as to whether if I were incinerated, whether my parents would have to make the payments on the car. That really worried me. I didn't really want them to remember me that way. And I actually checked it. I actually did. And they said, no, unless they've signed something, no. I said, well, who pays if I – he said, well, we take the loss. So we know now what happened. But I think that the journalism we have today, and I think it's been proved by the decline of CNN, which has really declined in viewership tremendously, to the point where I think their viewership on the average is like 0.5%
right.
of the American people, and yet they call themselves the first name in news. But they are not the first name in news. But I think they are changing now. They are under new
right.
management. There, you can see changes being made slowly. I hope the changes will become dramatic, and they will prove that a good news organization that gives you a good news report is always the best news organization.
That's right. Well, in fact, this week, the program, I think, is Reliable Sources with this fellow who's been doing that program, Brian Stelter, I think is his name.
Stelter,
that
yes.
That program came to an end. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I did not watch that show, but I saw clips, you know, that on the internet that would show up. And but I did read that the manager or whoever is running CNN now did call in a bunch of people and say something like, you know, you're going to see some changes and you may not like them. And
that's
I think
right.
A lot of
yes.
it is just driven by money, Bill. I mean, if you're getting, you know, I read this weekend that they're averaging 600,000 viewers an hour. Well,
yes.
Bill, there's a lot of other programs. I mean, if they would take the news, if they would just put pictures of, you know, of young couples getting married, I mean, 24/7,
yes.
they probably average more than that. And they wouldn't
That's
have
right.
to hire, they just run films. And they would probably get a bigger audience than 600,000 people. So they're, I think a lot of their concern is money. They're losing money. Maybe
oh,
not.
Yes.
Tech,
well,
maybe I think they still make money as far as the balance or the profit and loss statement, but they're
yeah.
leaving so much money on the table. That's the point. That when
yeah,
I say they're
is.
Losing money, it's because they're giving up so much money compared to Fox and, well, especially Fox. I guess they're still making money over
yes.
there, Bill.
Yes. Well, yes, and remember, CNN has an international division, which broadcasts throughout the world. They did make $1 billion last year, but that,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of profits for a company like that, that is not high. And
right.
remember, they have all news organizations have high expenses. They have the Ukraine war, but their audience is declining or has been declining. I'm hoping now, if they put on better programs, that the audience will increase to encourage. You know, a better operation. There are many ways to look at journalism. I remember when I was there, I was given a statistic that startled me, and that was that 20% of the copies of the New York Times were sold to people who simply wanted the want ads. They were looking for jobs, and you know, and that's fine. That was a service that
sure.
Times performed and performed very well. But we shouldn't assume that people who buy a newspaper always buy it because they're interested in what's happening in Southeast Asia. Sometimes they have other functions. They may like the crossword puzzle. Times was very popular for the crossword puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
They may want movie recommendations. You know, a bigger news organization like that performs many services. But the services overall in journalism have declined. You don't get the feeling that the people you're listening to are particularly knowledgeable. That's not in every case, by the way, of course. There are some who are very knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't get the feeling they're terribly devoted. And you certainly don't get the feeling that they're neutral. And I think that if they were to go back to traditional journalism and add to it some programs that may be on several sides of an issue, that they would actually do very well.
Well, you would think so. I think there is a market for that. And I guess CNN is going to put that to the test because there will be some changes over there. There is a station, by the way, or network that is trying to do that. I think it's called News Nation. And they have a fellow named Don Abrams who has a program at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to do a down-the-middle broadcast, you know, where it's more – I've seen some clips from that station, and it does seem to be more serious. It's not the, you know, the Trump 24/7 obsession that CNN has. But I don't know how that's going to work out, but it's called News Nation, and I haven't really had a chance to see much of it, but it's out there every night
yeah.
doing a newscast. And
I'll have to look it up.
Yeah, it did come across as being serious, at least I felt, especially this fellow Don Abrams, who I thought...
Are you
Abrams.
Thinking of Dan Abrams?
Well, Dan, yeah, maybe Dan, yeah, Dan, yeah. Who's...
Yes, he used to be a broadcaster at NBC, I believe.
Right, or, yeah, one of those. But now he's on with his station. He has his own program. And, like, he was doing a segment, I don't know whether he did it today or the last couple of days, but he was interviewing some expert on the Trump, whether the documents were classified or declassified and whatever the confusion was. about that. And I thought he did a great job. If I find the clip, I'm going to send it to you, because I thought he did a really nice job of asking questions that had nothing to do with Trump. They were just more serious questions that I think any voter would like to know. I mean, I like to know more about it, but it seems like they're just obsessed with Trump. They're either saying that Trump is a victim or that Trump is horrible. And after a while, Bill, I just shut it off, because I'm not learning anything. I prefer to go other sources and pick up more information that at least it's teaching me something. I mean, I don't need to hear how many times am I supposed to hear that Trump is a threat to democracy, for example. I mean, after you hear that a million times, what good is it?
And you like to talk down to the TV set and say, well, tell me in what way is he a threat to democracy?
Right.
I remember when this started, when Trump was very critical of the press, and they would start screaming, this is a threat to our democracy, the free press is so important. And I would say back to my TV set, yes, it is. But criticizing the press is not a threat to democracy.
That's
it probably
right.
is healthy for democracy. I just looked up, by the way, News Nation on my computer. Dan Abrams, yes, it is the same Dan Abrams that I remember. His father is Floyd Abrams, who was a very famous newspaper lawyer. And Dan Abrams himself is a lawyer, aside from a broadcaster, a chief legal affairs correspondent for ABC News. He's on Sirius Radio. He's been around a long time.
Well, I have to tell you, Bill, I didn't know much about him. I recognized his face because on television, that's one thing about TV, you recognize faces. So I knew that he had a background, but I wasn't exactly sure what it was. But I've seen him a couple of times now do interviews. And he is good, at least from my point of view. He's good because you could tell he's not leaning one way or the other. He's trying to get some questions answered, and I thought he was extremely good. And I like to see that effort succeed. I don't know if it's a 24/7 network. I have no idea. I just know Dan Abrams is the one that I've heard about. But his clips or his video clips are usually pretty good and pretty serious. So I would recommend at least his show to people. But, you know, one more thing, Bill, I wanted to, you were talking about threat to democracy, and this whole thing is so laughable because I used to remember when Dick Cheney was a threat to democracy. You remember that?
Yes. He was called Darth Vader.
Yes. And they even made a movie about him, and how he was manipulating the country into this war
President
and that
Bush,
war.
Yeah.
Yeah, and remember he shot that friend down here in Texas one time? And that became, you know, a nuclear war type of story. Mm-hmm. The whole thing was an accident, but obviously they turned it. So I just thought it was hilarious that now the media has gone from the daughter of the most dangerous man in the world to now
Trump
is the most dangerous man, and the daughter of the former most dangerous man has now discovered a new dangerous man, Bill.
Yes. Yeah, I thought it was very funny, by the way. It's very good what you just said. And also that they're now resurrecting Dick Cheney as a public servant. Now he's suddenly this wonderful public servant. But what I found very funny, I read this, I didn't see it on the air, that somebody on MSNBC got very upset with this. And they said, we have to remember that Liz Cheney is a conservative. And they said, let's not fall in love with her. You know, I mean, they're finally realizing that she's just another form of Republican.
Right.
But it is funny that she is now denouncing Donald Trump. And so is her father, by the way,
right,
as a danger to the Republic. So, boy, we got one dangerous guy one day. Another day we have somebody else. Tomorrow there'll be somebody else. After a while, it sounds like a Jackie Mason routine. He's this guy. He's a bad guy. Tomorrow he'll be a good guy.
Right. I know. It's hilarious. And then for me, I mean, it's amazing. She's now sitting around and, you know, hanging around with people who didn't want to certify her father's reelection, who used to call her father a war criminal and the most, you know, dangerous man. And that's who she's hanging around with. And I'm sitting, Liz, if you want to understand why you just got beaten by 40 points, look
that's
at your
right.
friends.
That's exactly right. And well, you know, and she now wants to run for president, and I'm sure we can all feel around us the
right.
wanting of Liz. I mean, haven't you seen the parades, the
yeah.
spontaneous
right.
demonstrations?
Right.
I mean,
she won't even
Liz.
Win Wyoming.
Yes. That's exactly right. Losing your home state is not good. That's what happened to Al Gore in the 2000 election. People don't realize that if he had won his home state of Tennessee, he would have won the election. But he
That's
didn't
exactly
win his home
right.
state.
That's right. 11 votes in, or whatever it was, in Tennessee, and he would have been president, and Florida would have been a meaningless – the Democrats would have conceded Florida on election night.
That's right.
Because he won
That's
Tennessee.
Right.
Who cares about Florida? But what makes that
well,
election so interesting, going back to that election for a minute before we take a break, and then I do want to get into the Trump, you know, the situation with the Department of Justice and all of that. But one thing about that election in 2000 is if you go back to the way the states broke down that year, that Al Gore would have been elected either by winning Tennessee or had he won Arkansas. Either way, he would
yes.
have gotten, because had he won Arkansas, he would have gotten 6 electoral votes, and he would have been president, because it was very close, as you remember. It was like 271,
yes.
267. So Bush was one vote over the minimum, or the whatever the 270 was. So not only did he lose Tennessee, but President Clinton couldn't deliver Arkansas that year. And that
mm-hmm.
is something that gets lost a lot when they get all obsessed with Florida, that they had the election, but they couldn't win their two states bill.
Well, that's true. And, you know, even going back to the 1972 election, I don't believe that George McGovern won his own home state.
No.
Which was one of the Dakotas, I don't recall. I think South Dakota.
Yeah.
He didn't. And I think Walter Mondale, when he ran in, I think Mondale did win his
yeah,
home
he did
state
win
Minnesota.
Minnesota. He did win Minnesota by 3,000 votes, I remember.
Yeah.
Watching a documentary one time of how Reagan came within 3,000 votes in Minnesota of winning all 50 states. That's pretty remarkable
yes.
when you look
well,
at it that way.
It is
remarkable.
And yet, you know, we remember back elections, and we don't remember them clearly. Back in 1944, President Roosevelt was running for his fourth term.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was unprecedented. A third term was unprecedented. He was running for his fourth term
yes.
as commander-in-chief of a victorious or a near-victorious army. The Second World War was in its last year. We were winning on all fronts. He did win the election, but it was not an overwhelming landslide. Thomas E.
No.
Dewey, who was almost as dull as AOC, he ran against Roosevelt. He did not come, you know, a whisker's distance away. Roosevelt won by a respectable margin, but it was not a landslide, and it was not this overwhelming victory that you would expect of a commander-in-chief in the largest war in human history. And I think the reason is, you know, even though the situation was serious around the world, people get tired of a president, even in wartime.
Right. That's right. Yeah, that I remember watching a documentary one time on that at the American Experience by this historian who just passed away a few days ago. And he was saying that that particular election, the popular vote was 53-46 or something like that.
That's
which
right.
was a lot
yes.
closer than anybody had anticipated. I mean, he still won. He still won easily, but it was not
yes.
the 57% or 58% that he had won the other times. But yes, Dick Cheney is now telling us, or Liz Cheney is now telling us who the most dangerous man in the world is and what she's going to do to prevent him from becoming president. If I was talking to Liz Cheney, I would say, Liz, just take off a couple of years and you'll be back. She's a very talented lady. I always liked her, by the way. I should say that. But I always liked Liz Cheney. She was a very conservative Republican. So I always liked her. But she really went nutty with her with Trump, and that's why she
yeah,
lost.
She,
that was the reason.
She became really kind of a caricature of the anti-Trump or
yes.
the never-Trumper, in the Republican Party. And I think one reason was that I have no doubt that her father always resented Trump because Trump didn't denounce him. That's not the right word, but criticized the Bush-Cheney administration. Look, Trump right now is in a very interesting position. Let me take a break, Bill, and then we'll pick up on this
because this is exactly the topic that I want to go to next. So let me take a little break, and then when we come back, I want to talk about exactly what you just mentioned and what happens next with President Trump and all these investigations. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, as we like to do on Mondays. We're chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, before we get to that very important topic, have you gotten have you bought a card yet for Dr. Fauci? He's retiring at the end of the year. And I thought maybe we should do both of us should sign the card on behalf of our podcast to Dr. Fauci, wishing him well in whatever he does next, Bill.
Well, you sign the card, Sylvia.
Okay, I will. All right, I'll do it.
I don't want an FBI agent at my door the next day, you know.
Well, that can happen. So I'll be happy to do it. I'll just say Silvio and friend.
And friend, right?
I'll just say on behalf of all our friends, I'll just say that to Dr. Fauci. I wish him well. I'm just joking when I say this. I wish him well, and I hope he enjoys his retirement, and I hope he throws a lot of opening day pitches, but he does a better job the next time he throws one, Bill.
Yes, right. Well, you know, I think that there will be a book written about him that may be balanced, but
hopefully.
I think that now that the concession has now been made by the Center for Disease Control that they made some mistakes, and I think that's pretty evident. They need much better communications in the event of a national crisis like the COVID crisis. And they also need to explain to people that scientific discoveries can be tentative, that they can be reversed. They can mm-hmm. be interpreted differently in 10 years. The discussion
right.
of science, we remember during the pandemic how CNN would proudly get on the air and say, follow the science, follow the science. And I wanted to talk back to the set and say, well, which science would you like to follow? There's a virologist at Yale says one thing. There's a virologist at Stanford that says something entirely different. Tell me who I should follow.
Right. Yeah, and of course, I think I've said this before, but much of what happened with the pandemic had to do with the fact that it was an election year. And I just hope the next time we have a pandemic that we don't have it in an election year, because that had more
yes.
to do with turning this into a circus, I think,
that's
than
right,
anything
that's
else.
Right.
And I think the this madness over Trump, over every little thing he would say, and you know, he was even apparently telling people to take detergent, to which he never said that. I mean, all these crazy things that they were saying about Trump, and so hopefully the next time we have a pandemic, it's in a year without elections, and I have a feeling that things will go down a little bit better. But let's talk about President Trump, because this could be, Bill, a very consequential week, not because of the affidavit. I don't think that's going to do much of anything. But consequential because he's apparently thinking of a lawsuit, a Fourth Amendment lawsuit.
Fourth Amendment, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a crazy idea, Bill. If you look this warrant was apparently get in there and pick up whatever you can find, which is, I don't think that's the way warrants ought to be, or at least maybe I'm too naive, Bill.
Well, I don't know anything about the process. I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on TV. I listen to them on TV, and I think there is a feeling that he might have a Fourth Amendment case. Let's explain the Fourth Amendment gives you basically the right of privacy, the right to be free of searches and seizures that violate your rights. It was written to protect people against, you know, false raids or law enforcement breaking into your home for reasons that are not legitimate. Again, I am not a lawyer. I've not studied this particular subject, but it would appear from some of the lawyers I've seen on television that he may in fact have a very valid case that the raid was not necessary, that it was a fishing expedition, that it was not specific enough. But let's see. Let's see if, first of all, he actually enters the suit.
Well, yes, and, you know, one thing about President Trump is that sometimes he likes publicity, and he may say one thing and never get around to it. You know, this may just be, something that he said. So I don't know if he'll do it, but I do think this raid has become a problem for the Biden administration, because I think a lot of fair-minded people, Bill, look at this and go, wait a minute. If you're going to do something like that, you better have a pretty good reason, Bill. You can't just do it because you were looking for some boxes of documents. And if it was that urgent, why did you wait 18 months to get nuclear secrets? I mean, what was the next president doing with it? 18 months with nuclear secrets? I mean, come on. That, I don't know. I don't feel very confident about the Secretary of State or whoever the responsible party is if for 18 months they let a former president sit around with nuclear secrets, Bill.
Yes. Well, and not only a former president, but apparently Hillary Clinton and some of her staff. I mean, the notion of files being in the wrong place or in the wrong hands came out during the investigation of the Russia collusion nonsense, which turned out to be real nonsense. But it turned out that Hillary Clinton, she had a server in her own home, and she would send emails that did not go through classification, and yet nothing happened to her. There really is a double standard of justice.
Yeah, no question about it. And I think everybody knows that. This is the thing, you know, when you talk to people, everybody knows, well, Hillary got away with it. It seems like that's not a secret, that most people who follow the news know that she got away with it. And they don't think it's right to go after one and not the other. I think that's what bothers a lot of people here, Bill.
I think that's true. And I think, you know, this is a country that has always put a great deal of emphasis on the whole concept of fairness, of treating people, as you said, equally. And I think they realize that it's not true. It is very difficult to get people to believe that government agencies would be in collusion with each other and would have as their objective making sure that Donald Trump doesn't run again. Now, I stress that's a charge that I make, that other people have made. I can't document it. It's just a feeling I have that when you look at the timing of all these things, that it really has to be political. I do not have documents to back up what I've said, but I think that is a widespread feeling in Washington.
Yes. Well, if I was talking to a Democrat, though, and I have said this to Democrats, in fact, just yesterday when we were having lunch, there's a very nice lady in our group, our lunch group, who's a Democrat, very nice lady. And I was saying to her, you know, you realize that by destroying Trump or taking him out, you're actually making it easier for a guy like Governor DeSantis to win the presidency. Because the reality is that, you know, whether we like or dislike Trump, he is probably the most controversial of any of the other GOP candidates. If you had a ticket,
yes,
let's say DeSantis, let's just say a ticket of DeSantis and the governor of Virginia, or DeSantis and, I don't know, somebody else, that would be a much more difficult ticket because it wouldn't have Trump on it. So that they wouldn't be able to dwell on Trump like they always like to do, Bill.
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, you probably noticed, I think pretty much everyone that I know mentions it, that DeSantis is now under a sustained press attack.
Yes.
It's beginning. They know that he's the guy next in line, and they are beginning to find all kinds of things wrong with him. He's a fascist. He's a dictator. He's the new Hitler. There's never been a governor as bad as this. In fact, one of the Charles Blow in the New York Times wrote a column about the threat of Ron DeSantis, and this is of course basically the old Democratic Party playbook. They scare the hell out of you. You know, it was the president of the United States when he was a senator, Joe Biden, in one of the election campaigns, told African Americans that if the Republicans were elected, they'd be sent back into slavery. Actually said it right out loud.
Yes.
And that is the game. That's the game plan. You're going to hear the word extremist used more and more. I see that now almost any Republican is described as an extremist, and we must defeat the extremist. I see that that great stateswoman of all nations, Stacey Abrams in Georgia, is now referring to the governor of Georgia as an extremist who must be defeated to defeat extremism and the extremism all over the country, and it will inspire the new Nazis if he's elected, and that's basically it. And they're going to do this, and they're one of the problems we have this year is we have a lot of candidates who, very frankly, on the Republican side, are not all that outstanding. And one of the things that makes you not outstanding is if you slip up in saying something. I have no doubt that we're going to have a candidate who's going to get up and make a speech and talk about the possibility of privatizing Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it never happens, because within 30 minutes, that will be the Democratic Party line. They're going to take your Social Security away from you. It's made very simple. Because it's a left-leaning press in America, the press doesn't seem to care that this goes on. It goes on all the time. But, we've become so used to people being denounced in such strong terms that it has become part of our process. Now, it is certainly true that in past election campaigns, we've had some pretty rough ones, things said about presidential candidates. But it's getting to the point now where it's becoming the routine and the required routine.
Right, but I'm also wondering I agree with you, that's their new tactic, but I'm wondering if it's becoming a little bit like the boy who cried wolf, because after a while, it does seem to lose, I think, its luster. For example, Ron DeSantis being accused of being an extremist, but he's up 20 points with Hispanics in Florida, which is, a very interesting point. But you mentioned Social Security, Bill. It reminded me of a moment in the 1980 campaign when in the presidential plane, he was President Carter running for re-election against Governor Reagan. He actually played for the press a speech that then citizen Ronald Reagan had given back in 1964, I guess. Not the Goldwater speech, but another speech that he gave talking about how maybe Social Security would run out of money someday if we didn't reform it. And they ran that speech as another example of how Ronald Reagan was going to take your mom's Social Security away. And that's
absolutely.
That's an old tactic, but I'm beginning to wonder, though, just my reaction, because that's happening to Beto O'Rourke down here. Beto O'Rourke is that's all he does. He scares people with what he's saying. And he's down 10 points in the polls because he's not saying anything worthwhile except scaring people that if Governor Abbott is reelected, all these terrible things are going to happen, Bill. I mean, it's going to be like Texas is going to be like hell. You know, we're going to have a school shooting every other week and, all these crazy things. But after a while, people just tune it out, Bill. I think that's what happens, Bill.
Well, they do. They do. And what we're coming to now, of course, in the next couple of weeks, is the real beginning of the campaign.
Yes, that's true.
Which will be right after. And people will actually probably be paying more attention. But if they keep hearing the same garbage all over again, especially about a guy like the governor of Texas, he's been governor of Texas. We know what he does. I mean, and they're basically Beto or whatever he calls himself this year, I don't know. Maybe he needs a new non-name.
That's,
you know, now that the Republicans, the Democrats are losing the Hispanic vote, maybe he'll say, maybe an Asian name.
Right.
You know, maybe that would be a.
That's right. Or maybe he'll go back to being Robert Francis O'Rourke. Maybe he'll go back to his real name and drop all the Beto stuff. That might be the solution. I'll be Robert Francis O'Rourke all over again, you know, his birth certificate name. Maybe that's what he'll do, Bill. But
he was named, presumably he was named for Robert Kennedy. I don't know if that's true.
But I don't either.
Robert Kennedy, it's Robert Francis Kennedy. But no, I think Beto will look around at what name is important, and he'll say, well, let's see now. Who's important to my party? Teachers. Yes. I'm waiting for him to say, you know, in my spare time, I teach a class at the local poor person school, and people of all backgrounds. Some of these guys just do it. They assume identities they never had.
Right, right. And I think that's true of him, especially
yes.
Beto, because he has really, you know, I think that's part of his problem, that everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, he's going to get 40% of the vote, but he's going to lose fairly decisively. But I think he's phony. People, I mean, the other day when he had that encounter with a voter, he's sitting there talking about guns. As if he knows anything
yes.
about guns. He doesn't know a darn
yes.
thing about guns. And he's giving a lecture on the AR-15. I think I mentioned this last week. Giving
yeah.
a lecture on the AR-15 and how soldiers were using it in Vietnam.
Yeah, no, they weren't.
I mean, people who know anything listen to that guy and go, Beto, that's not true.
Didn't he serve a term as a congressman or as
yeah, he was. He was a congressman in El Paso, and before that he was in the city council. I mean, but in 2018, I guess what I'm trying to say is in 2018, he was able to get away with a lot of this because he was a new face running
That's
against
right.
Ted Cruz in a Democrat year. And let's just face it. I mean, look, I think Ted Cruz is an excellent senator, but I don't think that Ted Cruz had a lot of girls who wanted to go to the prom with him. I just don't think he's a very friendly guy. I mean, he's not
what
you would call, you know, he doesn't have a great personality, I'll put it that way, but he's a great senator. I love him as a senator.
Yes.
And so he had everything going for him in 2018, everything, including like $80 million that came from outside of Texasville.
Well, that's true. Well, that's, by the way, one of the most interesting phenomena in politics today is that many campaigns are mostly financed by out-of-state funds.
Yes.
And I think it's worth a real journalistic investigation because it is very much a corruption
yes.
of the intent of local elections. Local
right.
elections are supposed to represent that area, but especially in the Democratic Party, which has now become – really, the rich man's party. It's a role reversal in American politics. But the amount of money being raised by some candidates because of out-of-state contributions is massive, absolutely massive.
You know, that's a very interesting point because the other day I was having a conversation with my son, the lawyer, and we were talking about the fact that at one time senators were selected by the state legislatures. They were not elected as they are now. I think about 100 years ago they made that change. And I think that's one of the negative things about the senators being elected, that people from other states are funding their campaigns. When they were
yes.
elected by the state legislatures, that didn't happen because they
That's
were basically
right.
the product of state legislatures. And I'm beginning to wonder, you know, if maybe we shouldn't go back to that. Probably cannot go back to that, but I'm just saying that, you know, this is a consequence of the fact that these people become national celebrities, and they're now running
That's
in
right.
the entire country. Not really running in Texas. He's running in the whole country, Bill.
That's exactly right. And the millionaire class or billionaire class really does, I think, I'm sure, work with the political party to determine who needs the most money. And
mm-hmm.
it's money itself is a corrupting influence in in politics. It used to be called the mother's milk of politics, and I think it still is the mother's milk in politics. But it has reached the point now where it is hard to keep track of who's financing whom.
Right.
And the influence is now of money now is greater than it ever has been, in part because the cost of a campaign is greater. You know, they don't do this in England. They don't have these endless campaigns.
Yes.
They're relatively short. The candidates are mostly, especially at the national level in Britain, are mostly people with whom the British people are at least somewhat familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And what we do now, our long campaigns do have a purpose. And it's a purpose that many people underestimate. People get to know the candidates during a long campaign.
Right.
And there's value to that. But I think our political system is right now strained to the limits.
Yeah. Well, the one thing that concerns me the most is the money coming from other states. Because you basically have, you know, there's no competition in California. So the money from California basically goes to Texas and to Florida and to other places where all that money coming in could change an election. And that could be a problem. One last thing I wanted to touch, Bill, is we're almost running out of time here, but you have a great post at Urgent Agenda about cities in trouble and the crime in the cities. And I'm being too optimistic, but that has to be a campaign issue. If you live in one of these cities, you cannot be happy with your crime rate, Bill. But I don't know if it's going to have an impact, but it should have an impact, Bill.
Well, it should. And what is interesting also is that the crime is now beginning to seep into the suburbs from the cities.
Yes.
And that will definitely have an impact. But, you know, it is up to the Republican Party to make it a major national issue. Now, some Republicans will say, well, it's an issue in these big cities, but they're already Democratic cities. Why should we bother? Well, you bother because many people from suburban areas, ex-urban areas, go into these cities for work. And what happens in the city is of great importance to them. And the crime rates are rising. New York City 10 years ago, New York, was called and was the safest large city in America. It isn't anymore. It is not as horrible as it was in the late 1980s, early 1990s, but it's getting there, and the nature of the crimes is sadistic. It really is. You know, terrible, terrible crimes are being committed. Crime should be and will be a major issue if the Republicans know how to run a campaign. And that, I think, is very much in doubt right now. They do not seem focused on issues. They don't seem even focused on the election. And we have a Senate Majority Leader who does not seem overly enthusiastic about Republican candidates.
Yes, but if the Republicans, they may say, well, this is a blue city issue, but if it goes into the suburbs, then it's no longer a blue city issue.
That's right.
My friend Barry Castleman, who has a website, was telling me that he thinks, you know, I was talking to him about abortion and women, and he says, well, a lot of women are going to be more interested in crime in the suburbs than they are abortion. And that's true. A lot of these mothers, and they're very concerned about their kids, you know, driving at night and the crime coming into the suburbs. And I sure hope that senators, I mean, people running for the U.S. Senate, whether it's in Pennsylvania or wherever it is, that they focus on that, because that's a real issue, that you're not making that up, Bill. The numbers are there. The crime problem is 100% real. It's not a fake problem at all. It's a real problem. Now, here in Texas, it's not as bad as it is in other places, but the crime does, I mean, there's more crime in the blue areas than there is in the red areas. And a lot of has to do with the judges, Bill, the judges. If you get arrested in a blue, like Dallas, you'll be out in the street the next day. But if you get arrested in, I don't know, some of the other outlying areas, you're not getting out the next day because the judges are different, Bill.
Not only that, but we now have this new national gimmick called bail reform.
Oh, gosh.
And the actual effect of it here in New York has been devastating. People commit serious crimes, and as you say, they're out the next day waiting for their trial, which may be in 5 years. Right. And they have then and they then become repeaters while they're out on bail. I mean, with no bail from a previous crime, they commit another one.
Right. Well, this is like the right there in New York. There was a fellow who hit somebody from behind, became a national story. I mean, that fellow apparently was a repeat offender, I think, and it became a national story. I think your governor, frankly, had to eventually give up. Or give in.
That's exactly right. That's
but
exactly
that,
right.
You know, that's the kind of crap that we watch coming out of New York, and we're saying, wait a minute, is this the city that Giuliani was running 20 years ago? It doesn't look like it, Bill.
Well, it was actually Bloomberg running it 20 years ago, but it's the same geography, it's the same place, but it's a very different city.
It sure
it
is.
Lost,
it sure is.
It has lost so much of its dynamism. You go in and it's the kind of people are kind of existing. I don't know if it's going to come back fully. I think we're going to have urban problems for a long time.
Oh, I think so. I think so because once people leave, it's very tough for them to just come back. You know, once they leave, it's very tough for them to come back. Well, Bill, as always, thank you for your time, and I'll keep you updated on our weather reports. Right now,
please
it's not raining, and I think the rain is over now. We've had our rain. So now we just have to let the water sink in.
Okay. I hope good luck to you on that.
All right. Well, thank you. Have a wonderful day, Bill. Thank you for joining us, and keep up the great work at Urgent Agenda.
Thank you, Sylvia. Talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week. Our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. I always have a great time when we talk to Bill. Bye-bye, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.